Good morning. How's everyone doing? Doing okay? Good, good. So, 3 weeks ago, I went to a protest in Oklahoma having to do with the detention of migrant children. And a number of people have said they wanted to hear the story, so I thought I would tell the story in my Dharma talk this morning. And I think it's appropriate for a Dharma talk to talk about this. I think it says something about interconnectedness. It says something about taking action in the world. And it says something about the inner work that we can do to prepare for taking action. So the way I'm arranging this is I'm going to tell you 13 things I learned on my trip. But the first thing is going to be before the trip started. Hope that's okay. So, number one. Sometimes it's good to be impulsive. So it was a Wednesday evening, and Kathy and I were making dinner. And I said to her, I got this email from the SZBA. That's the Soto Zen Buddhist Association. It's a national association of Soto Zen Buddhist priests. And it was about this action at Fort Sill in Lawton, Oklahoma. And the government was planning to transfer 1,400 unaccompanied children to Fort Sill to detain them there, to bring them up from Texas, I think. And SZBA was sending out a call for Buddhist priests to come and to be part of a protest down there and to hold a memorial service. And we had been invited to do this by organizers of the larger rally. There was a connection with Buddhism and Fort Sill because Fort Sill was the site of detention of Japanese Americans during World War II, including 90 Buddhist priests. So I said, you know, I wish I could go because they're asking for priests to come. It's that my status as a priest would be helpful. I could wear my robes. Maybe I could make a difference. But, you know, I've got all this stuff to do here. I've got the Capitol campaign. I've got this. I've got that. And Kathy says, you should go. And I'm like, really? Yes, about a Kathy. And she said, you know, it's simple. Children do not belong in cages. Families should not be separated at the border. And we both get very emotional about this issue. I mean, these are children. These are like our children. They're seeking asylum. They're coming to this country asking for help, and they're being put in cages. It's just crazy. It's not really a political issue. It's a human issue. So we talked about it a little more, and I decided I would leave for Oklahoma the next day. Thing number two. Fort Sill was a detention center for Native Americans. So Fort Sill is southwest of Oklahoma City. It's pretty close to the Texas border. It was established as an army outpost in 1869, and it was a headquarters for a war of attrition against the Comanches, Kiowas, and Southern Cheyennes. In 1894, Geronimo and 341 other Chiricahua Apaches were detained there, and that's where Geronimo died, at Fort Sill, 15 years later. So the last Indian lands in Oklahoma were opened to settlement by whites in 1901. With the Indians subdued, Fort Sill changed from a cavalry post to an artillery post. Number three, it's a long drive to Oklahoma. 12 and a half hours, according to GPS, but it took me longer than that, and both coming and going, I spread it out to 2 days. And I wanted to drive. I've always enjoyed taking long drives by myself. It feels like I can fall into a kind of a mindful rhythm when I take long drives. And sometimes I arrive in a much more sort of focused, mindful state than when I began. And that very seldom happens with flying. There's a lot going on when you fly. And I thought, I need this time because I need to prepare my mind for what's coming. It was I was having a lot of thoughts about this. And one thing, well, foremost on my mind is that there were some risks involved. Not huge risks, but enough that I needed to prepare. And I knew that any risks I would be taking would be nothing compared to the risks taken by people who choose to engage in civil disobedience and may go to jail or even prison, or people who place themselves between aggressors and other people in order to protect someone, or people of color simply living their day-to-day lives. You know, I can't really know what that's like. And I didn't really expect anything bad to happen. And in fact, I got an email the night before I left that said that the organizers of the Buddhist portion of the action would do their best to make sure that none of us got arrested and none of us got hurt. Still, I knew there was some possibility something could go wrong. And I'll admit, I'm not really too brave when it comes to this type of thing. And a couple of things were on my mind, and one was that the action could attract a large number of counter-demonstrators. I didn't know. They mentioned that in one of the emails. There could be counter-demonstrators, and I thought, I remembered Charlottesville and seeing a video. There was a group of clergy there that they were afraid for their lives in Charlottesville. And the second fear was that I would just kind of get caught up with everyone else, and that everyone would be arrested, you know, and I'd be charged with some crime or something. And again, not too likely, but it's on my mind. So to prepare myself, I was very mindful. I was very mindful about driving. Didn't turn on the radio. I drove very carefully. I drove generously. I let people in. I did not cut people off. I really got in sync with my car. And I was mindful at my stops as well. If I was pumping gas or waiting in line to get some lunch or something like that, or just washing my hands, I just kept coming back, And my mind was very active at first. And all through Minnesota and Iowa, I noticed this recurring pattern in my mind. I kept thinking about imagining scenarios where I was confronted with counter-demonstrators or police or military authorities, and what I would say to them to make them understand me and not hurt me. And I kept coming back to this, and I thought, that's kind of a weird approach, you know, kind of useless to try to speculate about every possible thing that could go wrong and what you would do in order to fix the situation. And I thought, well, that's my brain trying to exercise control over the situation, right? If you can anticipate everything that'll go wrong and come up with a plan, then you'll be okay. But of course, you really can't do that. It's impossible to attain that kind of certainty. So I went a little deeper. I knew I had to go a little deeper. I had to get beneath that thought layer and go to the real arena where I'd work all of this out, which was at the level of my fears. And so I was mindful of my body while driving, carefully, of course. And I was aware that I had this kind of tight band at the top of my stomach, kind of the bottom of my rib area, which was pretty persistent, just kind of a tightness there, which is unusual. I don't usually have that. So I knew this is about where I'm going. And I did what we often recommend that you do in Zen practice, which is that you let the thoughts go and you feel that feeling. And you kind of ask, what does this have to tell me? And you spend time with that feeling, with that physical feeling. And in doing that, you find that your mind wants to keep reasserting itself in about 1,000 different ways. But each time that happens, you come back and you spend time with the thing. And I did that. And about the time I got to Kansas, which was the end of my first day's driving, I had managed to leave my head and get into my body. And I knew that's where I had to stay for the whole weekend, that I had to act from that place of fear, not in fear, not acting with fear, but act from a place where I'm holding the fear, I'm aware of it, but I'm also aware of my determination, and I'm also aware of my vow to maintain the dignity and solemnity that fit my role as a priest during this action, no matter what would happen. So that's where I stayed. Number four. Fort Sill was also the site of internment for Japanese Americans during World War II. As you probably know, almost all Japanese Americans in the country were rounded up and placed in various camps during the war. And 700 Japanese American men were held at Fort Sill. These were community leaders, a special place for them, I guess. And three of them died there. One of them was named Kanesaburo Oshima. I'm sure I've mispronounced his first name. Mr. Oshima. He was from Hawaii. He had 11 children. He basically had a mental breakdown during his detention, not too surprising, and he started climbing the fence, and he was shot in the back of the head and killed by a guard. The next day was May 13th, 1942, and on that day, as guards pointed machine guns at them, the 90 Buddhist priests who were interned there held a funeral service for Mr. Oshima and the other two men who had died. Number five, it's really good to have friends. So I got to Lawton at about 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, and I went to the headquarters, which was a motel where all the Buddhists were staying, and there was a room there that we used for kind of a staging area, and I found a few priests in this room arranging paper cranes, because they had put out a call for people to fold paper cranes and send them as a sign of that they were with us. And so Buddhists throughout the country did this. I think a majority of them probably Japanese-American Buddhist congregations. And there was table after table with these strings of cranes. There were 5,000 cranes there. So I helped a little bit putting clips on some of the cranes so we could hang them on a rope to display them the next day. And then later more people came, and we held a series of meetings to plan our action for the next day. And if you get 25 Buddhist priests together, there's a lot of aspiration for precision and care, and it takes a while. But we were precise, I tell you. So there were people there that I knew from SZBA. One is a person who's going to be here as a guest speaker on September 22nd. Her name is Inryu Ponce Barger. She's from Washington, D.C. She's a friend of mine. I think it'll be great to have her here. Tenku Ruff, who's president of the SZBA, was there also. And there were several others I knew. And you get a lot of strength from the people around you. Everyone seemed quite relaxed and quite alert at the same time, if you know what I mean. And I made new friends, a lot of new friends. So the Buddhist component of this action wasn't organized by SZBA. It was organized by Tsuru for Solidarity. Tsuru, T-S-U-R-U. And that's a group, I'll tell you what the website says. It's a group that is a way to give voice to the moral outrage of the Japanese-American community at ongoing mass detentions in the U.S., and to show solidarity with frontline immigrant communities fighting injustice, mass incarceration, and deportation. So that's Tsuru for Solidarity. I think at least half the priests there were Japanese-American. Tsuru was led at this action by Duncan Ryuken Williams, who wrote a book called American Sutra about the internment during World War II. And he's just wonderful. He's kind and gentle. He's persistent and firm. He's compassionate. And I decided just to trust. I thought, I'm going to just trust this guy. This guy's wonderful. And if we're lucky, we may get him to speak here next year. I'm talking to him about it. He may be coming through the cities in the spring. So it's good to have friends. And I decided to trust. Number six. Fort Sill was the planned detention site for 1,400 migrant children. The government announced that on June 11th, the Department of Health and Human Services. As far as I can tell, they were children who were unaccompanied when they crossed the border. Whether that also included children who had been separated from their parents, I really don't know. But I do know a lot came together at Fort Sill. It was a detention site. You could call it a concentration camp for Native Americans and then for Japanese Americans. And now it was planned to be a detention site for migrants from Mexico and Central America. These are all people of color. There's a pattern here. It's not a coincidence. There's interconnectedness going on here. And I feel that it's our obligation to see that interconnectedness, to see what it's about. Number 7, there is hope for the future. So the larger action was staged by a coalition of many groups. Black Lives Matter, Indigenous Environmental Network, Women's March Oklahoma, a lot of other groups. But the main organizing force, it appeared to me, was Dream Action Oklahoma, which is affiliated with United We Dream, which is a national organization. So these were dreamers. These were young Hispanic people, really young, many of them undocumented. And Friday night, after we had all of our meetings, we went to a joint meeting with this group, and there were about 200 dreamers there. And there was food, and there were speeches, and there were people practicing because the action was going to be very well orchestrated the next day. And they were just great. They were organized. They were passionate. They were energetic. They had some humor. Some of them wore shirts that said, undocumented, unapologetic, unafraid. And I just can't tell you how much seeing their courage and their energy filled me with hope. Number 8, protest is serious business. So finally, you know, we got some sleep, and at 10 a.m. the next day, Saturday, the time came. So we drove in kind of a caravan, and we gathered near one of Fort Sill's gates at, of all places, a car wash. There was this big car wash, and there were these bays that nobody was using, so we gathered in them in the shade, which was important because it was already 90 degrees, and there was a hot wind, which I'm told is an Oklahoma thing, and we were wearing our robes, which can get really heavy. So we were just kind of in there conserving energy, watching as people came in. And 5 busloads of people came in, a lot of individuals, and eventually we lined up, and it was time to march to the gate. And we priests stayed together, and we walked 4 abreast. And it felt good to be wearing robes and to walk silently for the most part with mindfulness and dignity. And it was kind of quietly exhilarating to, in the midst of all of that, you know, shouting and chanting and passion and everything, to sort of maintain this mindfulness. So the group, about 500 people, I would estimate about 500 people, I've heard estimates of up to 1,000. The group filled the whole road, which was 4 lanes wide, so we're marching toward the gates. And then cars started coming in behind, and these were people who wanted to get onto the base. And some of them started getting angry, and some of them just laid on their horns for a long time. And I could hear a woman just yelling and swearing for a long time. And there were people designated to deal with this kind of thing, so I just kind of kept my mind on what I was doing. And so we were at the back of the group, when we came to the gate, so there were these 500 people in front of us, arranged in this really kind of disciplined way, I think 10 abreast. Most of them were wearing Mylar blankets. You know those Mylar blankets to show solidarity with those children? And it was a hot, sunny day, and they were glinting in the sun. I mean, sometimes you'd almost be blinded. And it was really quite a sight visually. So they do these speeches and things, and then at one point there's a signal, and they all turn around toward us, and they drop their Mylar blankets, and they take a knee, and they raise one fist, and they're perfectly silent. And they're looking at us, and that's giving us space to hold our memorial service, which we had been asked to hold here. So we immediately went into chanting the Heart Sutra in Japanese, and we were gathered on the median, 4 abreast, And the median was a deliberate choice. We thought we'd be less likely to be arrested if we weren't out in the street. We had something that was called a rapid alter setup team, which is something I have not encountered before in my years of Buddhist practice, because we needed the service to happen really fast. So the team, they set up a small table. They had a Buddha on there. It was a Buddha that had been carved in the Manzanar detention camp during World War II, and a framed portrait of Mr. Oshima, and two leis from Hawaii, tropical greenery, that had been sent by Mr. Oshima's granddaughter, Jiko Nakati, who's a Buddhist priest in Hawaii. And so we chanted the Heart Sutra. This was our memorial service for Mr. Oshima, just like the memorial service that had been held in 1942. We didn't have 90 Buddhist priests, but we had 25. And as the service was going on, there was a lone counter demonstrator right next to us. And I didn't see this guy, because I was just doing what I was doing and maintaining mindfulness. But apparently everybody else saw him, and I got filled in on this story later. He was carrying a flag on a long pole that said Trump 2020. Oklahoma is an open carry state, and he had a pistol in a holster and two extra clips and a knife and some mace. And one person said he ran hurriedly toward us when we started chanting. There were people designated to deal with this kind of thing, as I said, and there were members of the American Indian movement who intervened there and stood between him and us. And I am grateful to them. So they were using their bodies as a shield to protect us. And they said he made it clear that if he felt his life was in danger, he would shoot, and that he was looking for a fight. But they stayed with him the whole time, and there were no further incidents, I guess you could say. So, right after the service, we turned around. I thought, okay, we're done now. But then people started blocking traffic. And I knew that there would be some kind of civil disobedience because it had been mentioned the night before, but I didn't know what it would be. I thought probably a few people would try to go on to the base or something. But they were blocking traffic. We were right next to an interstate, and so there was a ramp, exit ramp, coming down from the interstate, and so they blocked that exit ramp. That's the part I could see from where I was. And cars would come, and they would stop, and they were, obviously drivers were getting angry, and then cars started going around on the grass to try to get around. The people were blocking, so people would go out there and block further, so you had sort of three layers. And there was one guy in front in a pickup truck who appeared really angry, and he just started kind of inching forward, and people got out of his way. But there was one guy who just stood right in front of him, you know, and the message was, if you go further, you're going to have to run me over. And so the guy did not go further. And I was, of course, I was afraid someone would get hurt. I didn't know what was going to happen. The police were hanging back during all of this. They were visible up on the overpass, but there weren't any down among us. But that blocking of traffic continued for a while, not a long time, maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And then we were all back out in the street again, and we marched away from the gates. And we went under the overpass that was there because it was so hot. So we were all under this overpass, chanting and yelling and giving speeches, and it was kind of a bizarre situation. You know, the acoustics under there were pretty good. So much energy. And we priests kind of found ourselves up above looking down at everyone, and all this wonderful energy directed at us. And everyone was chanting, close the camps now. Close the camps now. Close the camps now. Because that was our demand. You know, close the camps. Not, we want better camps or different camps, or we want to move to a more humane place. There should be no camps. If people are applying for asylum, they should be free while that asylum process is going on. And at some point, Reverend Nakao and Reverend Williams placed the leis over the barrel of a cannon, which was just outside the Fort Sill gate. Number 9, trauma inflicted on racial or ethnic groups is intergenerational. Of course, Native Americans today are still dealing with genocide that happened a long time ago and continues, you could say. And there were many Native Americans from different tribes at this action who could attest to that. And the Japanese American experience, you know, it's something I've known about intellectually a long time since I was a child, but it's only recently kind of begun to hit me what that was like. I mean, imagine if you're Japanese American and you're descended from someone who was here during World War II, like everybody, all of your ancestors, everybody they knew, they were all detained and they lost their property. And, you know, can you imagine that, what the effect was on that whole community and what the effects are continuing even today? If you knew that happened to your grandparents or your parents, what would that be like? And these migrant children, the ones to be housed at Fort Sill and the ones forcibly separated from their parents at the border and the ones who are kept in cages, are going to feel this trauma for the rest of their lives. And their children will feel it and their grandchildren will feel it. Number 10, there is healing power in ceremony. So that afternoon, we had a brief rest, and then we had the second part of the action in a city park. And there was food, and there were speeches, and it came time for us to conduct a second memorial service, which we had been asked to do. And we wanted to do that in a way that would be meaningful for everyone. So we wanted to display the cranes. So to begin the ceremony, we got about 10 volunteers from among the dreamers, and they were all holding a long rope up like this. So it was about maybe 15 feet long rope. And then to start the ceremony, priests came together, came up four at a time with strings of cranes to hang on the rope. And priests did that a couple of times, and then other people came, more dreamers came, and they kept adding the cranes until there were these 5,000 colorful cranes, and that was the background. And then in front of that was a long table which served as an altar. And Mr. Oshima's picture was there, and the Buddha was there. And the priests lined up perpendicular to that table. And we chanted continuously in Japanese the three sacred vows. So, and we asked people to approach the altar, and so they did that walking through kind of a corridor where they had priests chanting on both sides. And the heart of the ceremony was when people were invited to write names on memorial tablets. So memorial tablets are a Japanese thing. We have one for Katagiri right over here in the Founders Hall. And these looked like that, but they were made from paper. And so first, I think, there were three tablets for the Japanese American men that were offered, then tablets for 10 children who have died in the custody of U.S. border officials or at the border. And then a member of the American Indian Movement, Michael Topalm, brought up memorial tablets containing the names of White Bear and Woman's Heart, who were Kiowa chiefs, and Geronimo, who was an Apache chief. And then everyone in attendance was invited to write down names on a tablet of anyone who had experienced forced removal, deportation, sexual violence, or death during the migration process. And we had no idea whether people would do this, whether the young people would want to do this, whether it would be meaningful to them, but they started coming. And again, I wasn't looking around, but I could see out of the corner of my eye. And mostly they had orange shirts for this occasion, and they just kept coming. They just kept coming. They just kept adding these tablets. And I think there were over 100 of them, and the table was just covered with all of these names of people who had been hurt during this process. And it was, and I cried, and it was beautiful, and it was sad. And lots of people cried. And it was a good thing to do. And maybe ceremony can help to heal trauma, even intergenerational trauma. And maybe ceremony can even help to heal the trauma associated with a particular place. Maybe the karma at Fort Sill was altered a little bit that day. So one member of our group, whose name was Geshen Claire Greenwood, wrote in an article, "In Oklahoma, I was reminded that Buddhist priests are first and foremost community healers, and we have a responsibility to facilitate healing." Duncan Williams said in an interview, "Remembering the ancestors is kind of Buddhism at its root," and he believes that Buddhist memorial services can be used for grieving contemporary problems of racial trauma. Because if you remember people from the past, that can cause the participant to heal. And we say sometimes we're dedicating the merit of what we do to those who have died, and we do that, but it's really about us too. It's about the living and how we can find courage. And Ms. Nakata from Hawaii said in an email, "The members of my Oshima family all feel embraced by your compassion. This service for my grandfather has brought healing and peace to our hearts." So I was so glad that we had been invited. I was so glad to be there in a support role. I didn't lead anything there. Throughout this talk, I've been saying we did this and we did that, but that's not to take credit at all, and I only got in on a little bit of last-minute planning. I mean, this was organized by other people. This whole action was organized by people of color, and I just showed up and participated. And I think the Buddhist contingent just showed up and helped maybe to channel some of the spiritual energy that was already there. And I think we helped to create a space that allowed people to be vulnerable and reflective at the same time that they were appropriately bringing their anger and their defiance. And that kind of gave this action a dimension that you seldom see. A little different from an ordinary action, I think. Number 11, the future is female. So that evening we had a debrief back at our headquarters, and one of the last people to speak was Grace Shearson, and she pointed out that there were 21 people in that room at the debrief, and 14 of them were female. A majority of the priests there were female, and the great majority, as that I could see, of the really visible leaders of the Dreamers were female as well. And I think this is very, very good. And I don't know if the women knew how much the men relied on their strength over that weekend. Number 12, everything we do is prayer. So sometimes we feel despair. The problems facing the world are daunting. Sometimes they're so daunting we need to take a little break for a while and not think about it. But there is hope too. There are so many reasons for hope. We don't know whether hope or despair ultimately will win inside of us, but we do know that we can cultivate hope. We can water those helpful seeds. And one way we water those helpful seeds is by taking action. When we're doing something, even the smallest actions, even the smallest little bits of kindness, even the smallest little bits of mindfulness help us to engender hope. Someone there quoted a Native American elder who had been present that day. Someone had asked him about when he prayed, and he said, "Everything we do is prayer." And I think that's true of us too in our Japanese Soto Zen tradition. Every action that we take, every action that we can put our heart into, do wholeheartedly, be present with, that's a kind of prayer. We don't call it that. It's a kind of being present in the moment that honors all things and the interconnectedness of all things. And we can do this practice anytime we want. We can drive very carefully. We can take care of our homes very carefully. We can take care of our Zen center. We can pay great attention to our interactions with others. And sometimes we can take a leap and do something that scares us. Each and everything we do matters. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. You do it because it's the thing to do. You maybe don't know whether you're going to get any results or not, but you do it. You do it because it's the thing to do. Number 13, but sometimes you do get results. So 4 days after the protest occurred, a senator from Oklahoma announced that the plans to use Fort Sill as a detention center for children had been put on hold. And about a week after the protest, the government announced that the plans had been canceled. So it is not going to happen. And the reason they gave was that there were fewer unaccompanied children crossing the border, and so they didn't need Fort Sill anymore. And I don't know, was that the real reason? Was it because of us? We'll probably never know. Tsuru for Solidarity said, "This victory is a direct result of solidarity, organizing, and protest." Well, I hope so. I hope so. That's one camp that's not going to happen. But there are a lot of other camps. I'm glad I went. All in all, I think it's one of the best things I ever did. And sometimes things work. Every act is a prayer. Everything that we do matters. So let's take heart. Let's make the world better. And let's do it together. Thank you. That's what I have to say. That's the story of my trip. And we have a little time. I would love to hear comments or questions if you have them. Yes, John.
Well, thank you. All 13 points were very important. But number 12 for me, when you said everything we do is prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Paraphrase. And it made me think of the fifth point of the five remembrances. My actions are my only true belongings. My actions form the foundation upon which I stand. And it fits in really well with the number 12 point there. So I thank you for that.
It does. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, Terrace.
Just wondering if you knew what happened, what's going to happen to the kids since they're not going to be sent there. Like, what's they're not going there? Are they going somewhere else? Or are they being?
I don't know. I doubt that they're being set free. I feel like we would have heard about that. Maybe they'll continue to be held where they're being held now. But that kind of brings up an interesting question. Because someone mentioned down there during one of the meetings that, you know, maybe if these children get moved to Fort Sill, those will be better conditions than where they are now. So why should we oppose it? But I think you have to oppose it because we have to end this system of detaining children, and we can't argue that they should be moved to a better camp, you know. So that it kind of brings up that interesting question. I really don't know, but I do know that I hope every step of the way as the government tries to move people to new camps or whatever, that people will be there standing up and saying this is wrong. So thank you for that question. Yes, over here.
Are these children that were going to be Fort Sill, are these children that were coming to the border that crossed over unaccompanied, or is this from the ICE raids that started last month or what have you?
I think it's the former. Children who came across the border unaccompanied, without their parents.
What is the other option if the children were to stay here in this country as children? We're talking of ages from
17? Probably infants up to 18. Well, I think maybe treating them the way other children would be treated who are without parents to care for them. You know, they're seeking asylum. And they haven't broken any laws. And, you know, I know quite a lot about asylum, and it's been the way it's always worked is you come to this country, you apply for asylum, you enter the country, you wait for the asylum process to unfold, and you're not detained during that time. So I think that's how it should be now. So yeah. Thanks for the question, Jim.
Ted, I want to thank you for your talk and thank you for your activism. I think it's an excellent example of committed Buddhism in action. And I wanted to share with people that unfortunately there's going to be an opportunity to stand against ICE and against these caps even closer to home. In Appleton, Wisconsin, there was a private prison, and now ICE is working to contract with a private prison company to make that a detention center, to make that into a camp. And already there's actions taking place to stand up against that. So just wanted to make sure people were mindful of that. And I think the opportunity will present itself like the opportunity presented to you to stand together against this. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Was there one more person over here? Okay, Jeff.
No, I was just going to say, as part of the same thread, that there was originally some, maybe 6 months ago, there was a plan to set up a detention center at Pine Island. And one of the things that happened as a response to that was that a lot of groups and organizations went to a city council meeting and spoke out about what this would do to their community, what it would do to the young people who would get jobs there, as it hurts, the kinds of things that they would be asked to do. And, excuse me, as a consequence of that, Pine Island decided not to have the camp established there. So there are many things to do. And we can certainly keep people posted.
Okay. Yes.
A place on the Zen Center website that maybe there is now, but I haven't seen it, at least where we could go to for activism like this within our community?
Well, there is actually. There's a tab called Beyond Our Walls, and it deals with all kinds of things people within the Sangha are doing to, you know, reach out into the world, from, you know, Joyce Food Shelf and Habitat for Humanity. And we have a social justice group here, made up of Sangha members. And, so that's a good place to check out. No, it wasn't. That all happened so fast. Right. And the group, the social justice group, the dialogue and action group that we have here, they have an email. You can sign up for their email thread or listserv or whatever, and they send out stuff pretty fast, which is good because these things happen like in a day, you know. Yeah, and I think, Jeffrey, you could direct. You could ask Jeffrey if you would like to. And Jim, yeah. Either of those guys can help you get on that listserv. Yes.
Struck by the imagery of you walking with the others around you. You were in a prayerful, mindful mode. Everyone else was probably screaming and angry. And I think these forces together can create a lot of energy. It's so important, I think, to have this like disciplined, compassionate approach to social justice alongside the louder voices. Mm-hmm. So it was a wonderful thing, I think, that you were there.
Yeah, it was really special. I mean, we felt their energy, and that was part of us, too. And that was great. And I think they felt some of our quiet, and that was part of it too. And I feel like, you know, kind of bringing together that spirituality and vulnerability together with all of that passion is a powerful thing. So, okay, well, thank you, everyone. Okay, one more comment. How many priests were there?
Well, we're picturing a large group of loud protesters.
Oh, there were 25 priests and about 500 other folks. So,
with his description, I wanted a visual one.
Yeah.
How many people were shouting and how many people were praying?
Yeah, a lot shouting and a few praying. Yeah, thank you.
Some of the shouters were praying as well.
Yeah, yeah, and some of the priests were shouting too. and there were a few irreverent things said. So, okay, well, I think we should turn it over to our Doan now.